Accession number 31395, Rule 4.
We landed in Liverpool and we were sent to Harrogate, based in a nice posh hotel. And there we were sent down to Moss Bros to get our uniforms and dished out with our new ID cards and sent home on leave just in time for Christmas. Actually, I spent every year I was home for Christmas. Anyhow, I think they sent it on 2 weeks leave, but then they extended it to four.
So this is Christmas 43?
It's Christmas 43, yeah. That's right, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the next stage up was to go to Operation Training in OTU. But once again, we were hanging around. And then one day, I happened to look at DROs, daily routine orders, and I was down to take the other denomination's church parade on Sunday. I'd never taken a parade in my life. I thought, what the hell do I do? And you know, I thought, trying to remember what's happened. Anyhow, I managed to get them marching. We marched them to church and halted them and said to the sergeant, "Carry on, sergeant," and nipped in the church. Fortunately, didn't have to march them back. And then there was still the hold-up. So it was down to Sidmouth. Theoretically, on a battle course. I don't know what the hell they were supposed to be doing on a battle course. But they formed a football team on the course. So I volunteered to play football, which is good because when the others were slogging out and doing battle courses, and we were playing football. And we wanted to spin okay because we won a cup. And 40 years later, when I was at work, a rep came in and he showed me a photograph of me with this football team. I don't know where he got it from, but it was amazing. Anyhow, we kept going.
What was the battle course about?
I don't really know. I think it was just a question of keeping us fit, you know, doing exercise and cross countries and stuff like that.
There seems to have been an awful lot of delays in the kind of process of getting somebody to an operational squadron.
Yeah, when I look back, I spent a hell of a lot of time hanging around doing nothing, you know. Anyhow, the next thing we were sent on the advanced flying unit at Milham, in what was then called Cumberland, it's Cumbria now. And then again, it was we did bombing. We did cross countries, flew over Northern Ireland. I remember flying over Northern Ireland one morning, and it was absolutely gorgeous. You know, one of the lakes there, and it was beautiful. And
had you crewed up at this stage?
No. The next thing was operational training, where we got crewed up.
So with the first part of the training when you were in Cumberland, what did that involve? Was that just literally going with different pilots?
Yes, I think it was probably getting used to conditions of flying in England as opposed to Canada, you know, the weather conditions and restricted areas and things like that. You had to be a bit careful.
So would it be really, would you classify it as something like air experience or
yes.
something like that?
Yes.
To give you time. What were you flying in at that stage?
I think they were Anson's, but they were English Anson's, and you had to crank up the undercarriage where the Canadian undercarriages had hydraulics, so you wind and I remember we took up one day and we just wound the undercarriage up and they decided to go back in again, wind it down. Now we went We went to Oakley, as in Patricia. That's where we crewed up.
Can you tell me about the process of crewing up and how it works?
To the normal person, it was chaotic. You think it never worked. There was no compulsion. And they put all the different threads in the big hangar, well, except the flight engineers. We didn't get there until later. There was pilots, navigators, bombmen, as well as operators and gunners. And then it was up to you to meet somebody you fancied. And I was stood there, and this chap came wandering up. He was a flying officer, Ross. He had a navigator and a wireless up with him, and he said, got chatting, he liked to draw my hair. Then we got a couple of gunners, so we had a crew. A flying officer, Ross, and there was Jack Oxley, who was the navigator, Pete Thompson, who was the wireless operator, Jack Spencer, who was mid-upper, and Roy Pridgeon, who was rear gunner. And, then we were introduced to Wellingtons, Fly Wellingtons. And it was the usual thing there, get to know the aircraft, and then we do bombing and things like that, and night fighting exercises. It was high-level bombing, which I hadn't done before, but it was still on the old Mark 9 bomb site, so it wouldn't...
How did that differ from the kind of high-level from the low-level that you'd done before?
Well, you see, when you're down flying low, the ground seems to come to you very quickly. When you're up at 6,000 feet, it's much slower. So you've got more time to adjust whatever you're doing. Anyhow, we did move to a satellite drone called Westcott. It's completely OT. OTUs, we did about, I think we did 21 flights at Oakley and 15 at Westcott. And then we were deemed, okay. And it was interesting that when I was at OTU, I had to do some link training. And of course, I had done it, when I was a pilot. But the last two exercises I did was a beam approach landing and a Maltese cross, Holland instruments. And I didn't really realise that I'd been assessed on that until many years later. I happened to pick up my logbook, and then tucked at the back was my assessment. Exceptional. I couldn't believe it. Exceptional. But I know when I did the Maltese cross, when I got out from the cockpit, the instructor said, have a look at this. And I looked at it, oh, that's nice. I didn't realise it was...
Can you describe the link train and how it works?
Well, it was a machine where you sat in this mock-up of a cockpit with the hood closed. It was completely enclosed. So you're completely... dependent on flying on instruments. And whatever you did was traced on a table by what they call a crab. It followed what you were doing, so it would draw lines. So the instructor could tell exactly what you'd been doing. Yeah. And I was like, I couldn't believe it.
And were you getting that training on the link trainer specifically because you may have to take over?
I presume so. We're never told about it, it was just the fact, we do some training.
And what was the Wellington like as an aircraft?
Oh, it was a comfortable aircraft. Oh, yeah, I had a nice seat. Anyhow, we moved on from that to four-engine stuff, which was the Stirlings. And that's when we picked up our flight engineer, Gus Garbutt. and we got flying on there. I had a lovely seat there next to the pilot, you know. Part of my duties, I think, I used to help him with the flaps and things like that.
Just can you describe the cockpit for me in the steering?
It's very, very difficult to. It's a spacious cockpit, you know, with a very nice, very nice seats. But it's very difficult to describe to you, quite
much. Would you stay in the cockpit for the bombing?
No. And this would be down the hatch, and yeah, which was down at the front. No, just be like a rabbit.
What were your impressions of that as an aircraft?
It seemed very, very stable, but it was such a tall aircraft when it was on the ground. It really was tall. And I didn't realise it at the time, but I think my pilot was having really problems with this. And one morning we turned up dispersal and it disappeared. It was gone. And so they said, we'll get you a new pilot. So we hung around for about a week. And then we were introduced to our pilot. This is Jack Evans. Don't know where he came from, but we clicked. We had no problems at all. So we finished on Stirlings.
What had been the pilot's problem, do you think? Was he just having problems handling the aircraft?
I think he was. I think he was having troubles with his landing. I think it was this problem of, you know, judging how high he was. Actually, I wasn't all that worried because he had said to me he wanted to go out to the Far East and fly in Liberators. No way, mate. Anyhow, we finished up on Stirlings. And then we did a very, very quick conversion course onto Lancasters. I think it lasted 4 days. And then we were due for ops.
What did the conversion... You said it only lasted 4 days, but what would the conversion course involve?
Yeah, just as far as we were going to learning all about the Lancaster, as far as, you know, how to operate, how to fly it, how the thing worked, you know, just getting the general layout. No problems at all. It was a brilliant aircraft. But that's then we were going to be operational.
So can you tell me about arriving with your squadron and what squadron that was?
Yeah, we were posted to 115 Squadron, which was based near Ely, at a place called Wychford. We weren't there very long, actually, because as a crew, we never did an operation from there. I think our pilot did one as a second dickie, you know. But we were attached to Sea Flight, and we got up one day and said, "All right, Sea Flight, the whole of Sea Flight, you're going to form a new squadron, another squadron, 195, at Ratting Common." That's Ratting, Ratting Common, which was 8 or 9 miles from Cambridge. Now, apparently, 195 had been an army cooperation squadron, but had been disbanded. So we moved in, you know, the deserted airfield, and we were living in Nissen huts. We had an officer's mess. I was the only officer in the crew at that time. So obviously the first thing to do is have a look around, see where the pubs are, and I think the little village was West Ratting or something like that. Anyhow, there were two pubs there, and we decided that the Chestnuts was going to be ours. It was an old-fashioned, really nice old-fashioned pub, so that was our base, you see. Anyhow, we settled in, and then on the 20th of November 1944, we were up for our first operation.
Can I ask you a little bit about the airfield as well? Mm. You said you were in Nissen huts, but what can you describe the airfield to me as it would have looked? Because I assume it was one of the wartime constructed airfields.
Yes, it was, yeah. It was spread out, obviously. We've got got the airfield. I think there were three runways, you know, and dispersed all around it. And the living quarters and the messes were away from that, and the bomb store obviously was way out. So if it was attacked, the whole of lot wouldn't have gone along, you know, in one go. It was spread out. Just a typical wartime airfield, really. Yeah.
And your accommodation in Nissen Huts, what were they like?
They were quite comfortable. I think there were six beds in ours, in mine, with a coke stove. We had bat women. They kept the place tidy, made your beds for it. Couldn't be better. No, they were very comfortable. So long as you could organise some coke. So there were, you know, a few night raids on the coke store. No, it was fine. We got on. Settled in.
What was the mess like for you as an officer?
Oh, that was fine. You know, there was a bar and there was a recreation room with a snooker table. very comfortable. You know, that was a hut. That wasn't a Nissen hut. That was a proper timber hut.
And you being an officer, did you? You said that you chose a pub. Did you all socialise together as a crew?
Oh yes, yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. The only problem was, you see, that when you were on the base, you couldn't socialise together, because they had the sergeant's mess and we had the officer's mess. But off duty, yeah, oh yes, we definitely socialised. And funnily enough, the landlord at the Chestnuts turned out to be a very amicable gentleman. Because our flight engineer, Gus Garbutt, he was a married man, was a couple of young children, and if the landlord knew he was going on leave, he'd have a rabbit, you know. No, he was a smashing bloke, he really was, and no problem at all with him. No. Anyhow, I'll say the 20th of November, we were up for our first operation. Went in the briefing room and saw the name of the target on the board, and oh bloody hell, we thought it said Hamburg, but it didn't, it said Homburg, which was in the Ruhr, so didn't fancy going to Hamburg.
Why was that? What was the reason that you wouldn't have fancied Hamburg?
Well, Hamburg, you know, was a very heavily defended town. It was a key target, so we were very pleased to be doing the Ruhr. Actually, we seemed to be Ruhr-bashing the whole of most of the time. We were attacking the Ruhr, which was fair game, because that was the centre of the arms production, you know, Krupps and all that lot down there. Anyhow, we couldn't have made a very good job of Homburg, because we had to go back again the next day. I got the bomb command diaries, and I'm reading up in there, the second raid was very effective. So that was that.
So what are your memories of that first raid and the first time that you hadn't, you'd gone on an operation?
Well, I remember as we were taxiing out, on takeoff I used to stand behind the pilot and I thought, well, will I be able to hack this? Will I stand up to it? You don't know. You think you can, but you don't know. And quite a few people, you know, couldn't do it, and they crashed out, and they were LMF, lack of moral fibre, and they were demoted to the lowest of the low, and they had to clean out latrines. You know, they were really put through it.
So was it a genuine fear amongst the aircrew of letting each other down and not being able to do what
you were trained for? Nobody ever spoke about it, but I think it must have been at the back of everybody's mind, you know, what's going to happen to us, you know, can we cope if we have any problems? Anyhow, you know, it went off okay.
What was the sort of sensations of doing your job on that first target? Because I assume that although you've practiced before, you wouldn't have actually have been up, you wouldn't have been over anything that looked like a target at that stage, would you?
No, strangely enough, if I remember correct, we were bombing through cloud cover. Now, some of the planes were equipped with what they called GH. which was an improved version of the G navigational aid. And with that, they could actually home into a specific drop point, and then they would drop their bombs. Now, we had to formate on a GH kite, and they had yellow stripes on the tail planes. And when we formed in, when they bombed, we bombed. You know, it was a bit hit and miss. That's if you couldn't see the target, you know, you were bombing through clouds. But it seemed to be pretty effective, actually.
So what did Homburg look like as you went over it? Because obviously, again, it's this thing that you wouldn't have seen.
Well, I mean, we never saw it. We never saw it. We were bombing through cloud. We never saw the ground. Never saw the target.
Was there any anti-aircraft fire that you would have seen, or would there?
There's always anti-aircraft fire. They put up a box barrage once they'd sorted out where you were going. They would put up a box barrage, and you had to fly through that. And it was damned accurate on height. It really was accurate. The lap of the gods, whether you got through it or you didn't. But there was no turning back. You had to go through it. And
what was the sensation of that, going through that first one that you went through? Because it would have seen, I imagine it would have seemed strange at first, wouldn't it?
Well, we had seen films, you know, of what it, the puffs of the anti-aircraft as they as it exploded, and eventually we got used to it. But if it was just a dirty grey puff, that was all right. That was then, if you could see the flash, it was and as it got nearer and nearer, that was definitely clean underpants time. Yeah, now you had no option. You just went through it. And my pilots seem to have a happy knack. I don't know. He seemed to get on the outside edges of the bomber stream where it wasn't quite so heavy. But you got used to it. You just accepted it. That's what you had to do.
And the second night that you went back to it,
well, it was daytime actually. Oh, these were daytime. These were day raids.
So at this stage of the war, you were flying day raids.
Oh, yes.
Nighttime raids. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Most of my raids were. I did 8 night, and all the rest were day. Yeah. You see, at that time, the German fighter planes, they'd more or less been decimated, you know. So long as we had a fighter escort, that's when the Mustangs came in with their long range. So long as we had a fighter escort, we were pretty well covered, you know.
So the threat had diminished, had it, from potential fighter attack?
Oh, yes. Certainly during the day. In fact, I never saw a German fighter plane during the whole time. Not during the day. I did see one at night once. We were coming back. I can't remember where we'd been, but it was a lovely moonlight night. We were up about 20,000 and 19,000. And I was down the front, and all of a sudden I looked out. There was an ME-109 going past. About 200 yards away, he just went past. And he never attacked us. And I often wondered why. Had he run out of ammunition? Or had he decided, as far as he was concerned, the war was over? And there was no point in him risking his life. And another time during the day, I actually saw a German jet fighter, a twin jet fighter. He was way below us, going straight across 90 degrees to us, going like the clappers. He was way down. He wasn't attacking anybody. But I looked at him and, what the heck's that, you know? Couldn't seen that before.
So the second time you went back to Homburg, what did you feel about having to go back to the same target? Were you aware that things hadn't gone so well the first day?
Yeah, well, you know, we were a bit disappointed because we thought, oh, well, you know, that's dumb. It's the sort of thing where And the more you did, the more you realised that you couldn't do it exactly right the first time. Sometimes you did have to go back again. Yeah.
So what were the sensations, obviously, of completing? Were you happy about having completed your first operational flight and things had gone to plan?
Relief that it had gone to plan and we'd come back okay. And there was no panic. Everybody had done their jobs. It was fine. No, it was great. Yeah.
On the second rate, Homburg, were you able to see the target?
No,
that time?
No.
So again, it was bombing through cloud?
Bombing through cloud, yeah. Yeah. Anyhow, I say that was two in 2 days, and then we had a day off. The next day we went to Gelsenkirchen. That was 3 ops in 4 days. So we're 30 ops? Oh, we'll soon get through with this, you know. But anyhow, that was on the 23rd. And then we had a few days off. And then it was our first night raid, a place called Neuss, which was also down in the Ruhr. And we nearly always carried a 4,000-pound bomb, a cookie, as we call it. And 500 pounders as well. But the night raid, we had the 4,000 pounders, and then we had 14 canisters of incendiaries. That went okay.
How did that differ, doing that night raid, from the ones where you'd done the daylight raids?
Well, the night raid, the target was marked by pathfinders or leaders, and they dropped coloured target markers, reds or greens. And in the latter stages of the war, we had a master bomber who would circle and tell us which colour to bomb. bomb the second green on the right, kind of. But I think in the early days, it was just one of the bombing leader who did that. But you were told which the red or bomb the reds or the greens. You couldn't see much, you know.
This is what I was going to say. What could you actually see of the target when you did your first night raid?
Nothing very much. Only flashes, you know, as the bombs exploded, and the flashing of the anti-aircraft fire. I can't remember seeing any searchlights, but maybe they were. But no.
What were the conditions like when you did that first night raid? Were they cloudy or
no? From what I can remember, they were okay. You know, we saw the we saw the markers okay.
And with the markers, you know, when you saw the markers, were you being informed of that, or was the pilot being informed of that? Would you have to move towards the markers?
Oh yes, yeah.
Can you explain how that works?
As we ran in, I would sort out which marker I was going to go for, and then I would direct the pilot to fly towards that by giving him instructions. You know, if you want to come left, and then when he gets more steady, you know, and then if you're going straight for it, it was continue steady, and then when you got close enough, your bomb doors open, and then bombs away. Oh, incidentally. The setup for the release of the bombs was quite interesting. We had like a clock thing which was on a ratchet, and you turn it right round like that. And when you press the bomb release, that would start to move. And as it went past each stop, it would release a specific bomb. And it was designed so that it would drop them in a rotation. Not necessarily all together, but some from the front, some from the back, left, right. So not to upset the plane, the way the plane was behaving too badly. Of course, the cookie was the last to go, and that was always through the middle. Yeah, don't. But we at this stage we had the Mark 14 bomb sight, which was a vast improvement. It was semi-computerized, that's the only way I can think about it. I had a control panel on the right, and on that I would set the wind speed and direction, the terminal velocity of the bombs, because that depended on what kind of bomb you were taking, some going faster than others, and the rest of the information was fed into this box directly from the instruments, the speed, the height, and everything like that. And then there was a flexible drive to the sighting head, which was a movable arm which projected a beam of light onto a glass slide, which was controlled by a gyroscope. So theoretically, you could actually bomb in a turn. Now, this projected this